Welcome to the interview portion of Power Talk. I'm here today and privileged to be with a gentleman that I'm sure you're familiar with. If I'm introducing you to him, you haven't been around very much. It's probably more of a reintroduction. And that is Dr. Wayne Dyer. We're here in Hawaii in his escape route where he's writing another book. And if you're not familiar with Wayne, you should be. Certainly, he's written some of the best-selling books of all time in the area of personal development. Your Erroneous Zones, Pulling Your Own Strings, The Sky's the Limit, Gifts from Icus, and You'll See It When You Believe It. Wayne, I just want to first thank you for letting me get a chance to share with your family.
Wasn't that great?
Yeah, that was great. I walked in to see Wayne and his family, and I got attacked by seven children.
Kids know, though, Tony. Oh, yeah. I was really impressed because when they walked in, my children are very open and very loving, but very often a stranger will walk in and they are very skeptical and they check you out first like animals do, and they jumped right onto you. So I think there's an invisible quality that people send out, and if you have a love for children, that says an awful lot about you. And of course I have it great depth because my children are the most important things in my life. Yeah. And I can tell that you're a wonderful daddy too. It's nice having you there.
I appreciate that very much. Well, I think one of your gifts, from my perception, is the ability to have that child be totally alive inside of you. Mm-hmm. And that's where happiness comes from, when it's mm-hmm. natural. But why don't we start out by getting a little, we always start our Power Talks finding a little background mm-hmm. on people.
Sure.
So why don't you tell us, where did this philosophy of no limits, this lifestyle of really living life to the fullest, where did mm-hmm. all this come from for you? Where did it start? I know you had some painful challenges starting out in your childhood.
Yeah, well, they were challenges. They weren't painful.
Oh, that's good.
Truly, they weren't. See, I grew up in, I spent a 6 or 7 years in a series of foster homes. My mother had three boys by the time she was just a very young woman, and my father had spent some time in prison, and he was abusive and an alcoholic and an irresponsible person, and he stole from everyone, and this is why he went to jail. And he also just abandoned his family when I was just an infant. I was born in 1940, and my brothers were born in 38 and 36, so there was a depression at that time. It was a horrible financial times. My mother was working as a candy girl for Kresge's on the east side of Detroit, making $17 a week and trying to feed three children and figure out how to deal with the beatings that she was getting and the abuse and so on. So I ended up in a series of foster homes with my brother. My oldest brother went with my grandmother, and we were all reunited when I was almost 10. I come from a position at this point in my life that there are no accidents, that the universe is on purpose.
I agree.
And I know I know your material as well as you know mine. I listen to your tapes and read your books and know that we have a lot of similarities there. And I think that the childhood experiences that you get, even the ones that we, quote, call painful, are lessons. And there are exams given, and we either pass them or we just keep repeating
the same
them.
Lesson,
that's
right,
over and over again. Yeah. And so I look back upon that. I try to look back very objectively on those years when I was in a foster home and in years when I was away from my mother and things were happening that everybody else would sort of categorize as horrible and painful. And when you're a kid, you don't wake up every day and say, I'm an orphan again today. Isn't this awful?
Yeah. Unless somebody teaches you to think
right.
that way.
That's right. Unless you process. And I was always the one in the places that I lived where a mother would bring in a new child. It was just poverty. I mean, it was just, nobody had anything. And so everybody that ended up in these various homes was just because they didn't have anything. It wasn't anything other than that. And the mothers would bring their children in, or the church would bring a child in, and they'd always say, go get Wayne. And I was always out and back either playing or meditating or having a good time, because it was on a farm. Like, I mean, there were chicken coops and there was a lot of apple trees and peach trees, and it was just, to me, it was just where I was. I mean, what else do you know?
Yeah.
And they'd say, where's Wayne? And I'd come and they'd say, Wayne, this is Martha. I remember one time, and this little Martha was crying and she was all upset. And they said, Wayne, teach her how to spell her name. And I was about 3 years old. I had no idea how to spell Martha. And I just started guessing at it. And she said, no, that's not right. And we went off. And it was like I was the one that somehow had my purpose, whatever it is that you want to call it, was about teaching other people that they didn't have to be depressed because of the circumstances of their life. And I seem to always have known that.
You make a really interesting point, because so often people who are depressed or see themselves as depressed, that's part of their identity. And they have great times throughout the day.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, they don't remember any of it.
Yes,
you know, and they say, oh, I'm so depressed all the time.
I think that's one of the key differences between successful and unsuccessful people, by the way, is that successful people have a tendency to really recall the good.
Yes.
They remember. I mean, I think of my days at the at Mrs. Scarfe's house out in Mount Clemens at 231 Town Hall Road, and I think the only painful day I can ever remember was the day that her husband died. And it was just, I just didn't understand. I mean, he was there one moment and he was gone the next. And the only other one is I had appendicitis when I was a child and I got rushed to the hospital. But when I think of my time in the hospital with appendicitis in 1948, I remember the flowers and I remember the people.
I remember
the nurses. There's a big black nurse who would come in and put us on her knee because they had to give us penicillin in those days in these huge, huge, and they used dull needles in huge doses.
Oh, no.
And she was always the one who would coddle me and take it. I remember seeing my mother every day. Yeah. I mean, she came to the hospital every day after working where she was, and that was just glorious. I don't remember any other part of it. And I have a tendency to do that. I've been through a divorce, and I talked to my ex-wife, who is now remarried, and I'm remarried, and our lives are in nice places, and we're very good friends and all that. But whenever we would talk about what was going on in our marriage, she would always point out all of these things that I didn't even remember. You didn't take the kid on Halloween. I said, well, I remember being there on Halloween. I have sort of, I don't know whether I just created this or whatever, but I look back on my marriage to my ex-wife as a wonderful time. I think she was great. We just had to move along. I've never looked back and thought, oh, isn't that awful? Never done that.
Well, you talk so much about having reality-based thinking. Mm. And yet, isn't reality based on whatever we focus on?
Reality is just what I think about all day long. We are what we think about all day long. And it's like, that's the most important learning I think I have come to over the years, is that this body that we're in is really just like a garage where we park our soul, you know? It's just a place to put it, you know? And so you take care of it and you do all of that, but this isn't what it is. I've talked often about when my grandmother died, and they weighed her just before she went to the hospital. She weighed 133 pounds, and life left her body. Her body didn't weigh any less. I mean, her life, her very life, was invisible and weightless, as is everyone who's listening to it now.
Yes.
So you're just sort of trapped in this body temporarily, and you ought not to be thinking of it as who you are. But your reality is how you process it.
Yeah.
And that's one of the great lessons. I was talking to you, one of your producers, John, yesterday about somebody here who had come up to me and was very negative toward me, which is very rare. Do I ever attract anything like that? So this morning I was meditating on that, thinking, why did I attract this negative person who was very angry at me for being on his property when I shouldn't be or something like that? And I kept getting back in the meditation, and it's like it bothered me for a whole day. And then I was like over it in a second, satori, instant awakening. It was like, this is only a problem for you because you process it. The guy who came into your life in a negative way is just the path that he's on.
Yeah.
Your reality is how you are living with it.
Yes.
You know, it's like he came in to teach you a lesson.
Yes.
And the lesson is that you don't have to process him like that any longer. And it was gone. I realized that it was all totally within my power to let him go and to send him love. And I did. I sent him a couple of books. I found out where he works, and and I sent him a lesson. It may take him 20 years before he even reads it. He may never get it on this path. He may have to go through it all kinds of times and carry around that arrogance. But it's not mine. I don't have to own any of that.
Yeah.
It's the most freeing thing you have in the world to know that you can process life any way you want to.
Now, when you say process, let's clarify that. You really mean changing the way you think about things, the questions you ask yourself,
process
the way you focus.
It internally, absolutely.
You've gone through an incredible evolution, and in the spotlight, since 1976, I guess, is when your first book came out, right? And I was just a kid. I was 16 watching you, but I remember seeing
16.
You on TV. Yes.
I got sandals older than you. What am I doing in this interview?
But I remember watching you on television and thinking, that guy's hot. You know, this guy really, he's saying what's really true. Mm. You know, you didn't have anything else about you but what you really felt. And you were so clear in your communication that it stunned people.
Yeah, it was true. I had not arrogance, but an enormous amount of confidence.
Yes.
That,
they didn't know how to deal with that.
No. I can remember being on The Donahue Show and The Tonight Show and a few shows like that and saying things that they were so shocked at that they asked me to come back the next week. And I wasn't doing it for shock value. It was literally what I'd been saying all my life, only I just had a bigger audience. I mean, I'd been saying it as a school teacher, and I'd been saying it as a college professor, and at the lectures that I gave. And you
were a therapist for a while, too, right?
Oh, yeah, for many, many years. Yeah.
Now, what made you decide to write a book in the beginning?
Writing is the way I just express my soul. Writing isn't something I do. Writing is something that I am. And therefore it just comes out. I have to write. I mean, like Picasso had to paint, or it's like asking my wife, why are you such a great mother? You know, I mean, mothering is who she is, and she's just absolutely divine at it. writing I've been doing since I wrote my first novel when I was about 15 years old.
Wow.
Yeah, and when I was in the Navy, I spent 4 years in the military after high school, and I wrote 3 books while I was in the service. None of them were ever published, and I wrote maybe 100 essays, mostly on the things that I found objectionable about the military. You know,
that's probably why they weren't published.
And I would design ways to get around it without being beaten down by it, because I realized I couldn't beat the United States government and the United States Navy, and I couldn't give speeches about how absurd it was. But I also didn't have to be inspected, you know, where they would come along and stand you up and make you, shine your shoes in a certain way. I just figured out in my mind, which is where everything begins, in your mind, how could I get away with not ever getting inspected again and still be a part of this system? And in 4 years, I never had another inspection after I left boot camp.
How did you pull that off?
Every time an inspection would come along, I would figure out a way to be someplace else, where it would absolutely be necessary for me to be someplace else. The only time that I was a little bit devious was when I had somebody, when I tempted somebody to steal my shoes so that I couldn't go. I had to leave them out, but I would rather have lost my shoes and buy a new pair than to
a
have...
A man who needs to express his individuality and freedom anyway, whatever is necessary.
This is true. It absolutely
is
true.
Fantastic.
And I left the service knowing that I wouldn't ever go back to that. And it was the great lesson of being in the military.
Yeah.
The great lesson is that life, in your life, you have to learn not only what you love, but what you don't love. And you have to experience, I think, what you don't like, and then know it, and then know how to go beyond that.
And spend the time in the place you want to live and how you want to be.
Yeah.
That's neat. Yeah. I know when you put your first book together. Well, first of all, can I mention what you shared with me downstairs?
Sure, you can mention anything.
Oh, I appreciate that. I got a chance to visit with Wayne downstairs in his room where he's doing his writing here in Hawaii, and I was amazed that there are some similarities between us, but I think maybe even more extreme on your part. And that is, when I'm writing, I'm constantly pulling out all kinds of ideas from many different sources, but there are like 50 or 60 books strewn out all around where Wayne sits and writes.
Yeah.
And he bounces along and pulls from each of these. Now, why don't you describe a little bit about how you write, because I think it's how you live. There's a great deal of trust there.
It's called surrendering. I learned to do it about 10 years ago when I really honed this. And that was when I was speaking in Houston. There were about 3,500 people who had all paid a lot of money to come and hear me, and it was an evening with Wayne Dyer. And I had all my notes all arranged in exactly the way I wanted to, and everything was just exactly perfect. I was backstage doing the pacing that you do before you go on, and the meditating and the breathing, and the just getting yourself relaxed and the sort of divine guidance that you're seeking. And I realized that I didn't have my notes. They were gone.
Yes.
And they were back in the hotel room, which was 30 minutes away, and I was going on in 10 minutes. So I walked out on stage without any notes for the first time, and I surrendered. In that 10-minute period of time, I just said, all right, you know what you're doing, and you know how to do it, and you're good at this, and you're here for a reason, and there are 3,501 people in the room, in this room, and you're the one who's speaking, and 3,500 have paid to come and hear you. There must be a reason for that, and so get on purpose, get on purpose. Get off of your outcome, get off of how well you do, get off of how much money you're being paid, get off of all of that, and get on to, what are you here for?
Yeah.
And you're here to improve the quality of life for somebody else. That's all you can do. When you leave this planet, when you the measure of your life won't be in what you accumulated, it will be in what you gave. Since you can't get anything anyway, it's in giving. So I surrendered. And that was the beginning for me of surrendering. I've never used notes since in my life. It's not that I'm not prepared. I meditate before, and I know what I want to do. And I do that now with my writing. It gets to a point where you absolutely have a knowing. There's two ways to learn. One way is through fear and doubt, and so you learn through suffering. or another way is to learn through knowing, just an absolute knowing that you have guidance available to you, and that you're not alone, and that you can handle this, and that
you have a choice to feel that way right now, no matter what's happening in the environment.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I surround myself with the people and the books and the ideas and the things that I want. And I know that they will be there. I have an idea I know the areas I want to write about, and the areas of prosperity and creating health in your life and in your relationships and in your relationship to yourself and these kinds of things. I know about that.
Right.
So I know what my chapter titles are and my headings are and things like that. And the rest of it, I just absolutely trust. And when I stop, I was going to say stuck, but I don't get stuck. I don't have anything called writer's block anymore. I can write forever. I mean, my typewriter just goes and goes and goes. And sometimes it goes so fast that it smokes. I mean, it's just going
well, that fast. Part of the problem is you've got a typewriter there. That's an interesting point. You've got a typewriter down there. Is it the same typewriter you used to write your original book?
Yeah, it's the same typewriter. I've written everything I've ever written.
A Smith Corona?
Yeah, it's an old, old one, yeah. Yeah.
Well, you talk about living in the now. Now there are computers, Wayne.
Yeah,
what's the
I
deal
know.
Here? Why do you stay with the typewriter?
I have a thing about computers. I have some judgment there that I probably have to work on. But they
you gotta forgive your computers.
I do. Yeah, they collect so much information. There's sort of a big brotherish kind of thing about computers.
Something that could take away freedom.
Yes.
Huh?
Yeah. There is something like that, and it's like you press a button, and everything that you ever did when you wet your pants. I know it's written in there somewhere. All of the skeletons I have in my closet are in somebody's computer.
So you don't want to contribute to that.
Could be paranoia, but maybe not. But anyway, it's this trusting that,
yes,
that you get to that allows you to not just to write well or not just to speak well, which is what I do, but whether you're driving a cab or whether you're a dentist or whatever. It's what they call flow. Have you seen the book Flow?
Yes, I have.
I can't pronounce the author's name, but it's Zizek Oblinsky or something like that. But it's a fabulous, a whole notion that you get past judgment. And and I do this in my tennis. I play tennis every day at a pretty decent club level. And I have found my best tennis flows from when I'm off of outcome and I'm on purpose, when I'm just out there being. You know?
Well, what I'm impressed by you is to see your children, because your children live by flow.
Yeah, they do.
You know, I mean, when you walk in there and they attack you and love you and jump all over you and say, well, you know, that was my highlight. Meeting you was wonderful, but we've met before.
Yes, that's right. We
meeting
have,
your kids is really the peak experience,
it's
I got to
really
tell
is.
You.
You see, they're like that because my wife, Marcy, is like that, and I'm like that.
Yes.
Our relationship is like that.
Yes.
And I really believe that children emulate what they see around them. If you want to teach your children, you don't have to read a lot of books about how to do it. You just have to model what it is you'd like them to become. Just be that around them all the time. We get on a plane. Now, we've been coming here to Hawaii since those children were infants.
Yeah.
Right? They were conceived. All of them were conceived right here on Hawaii. I mean, this is a very, very special, magical place.
You better be careful.
Yes, I know. We're sweating that out right now.
An eighth child.
Yeah, right.
Oh, my gosh.
But when we get on the plane, we live in Florida. Now, we come to Hawaii. Now, that's halfway around the world, all right? That's a 13-hour deal. And when we get in the back of a plane, we fill up a plane. Those children, every single time, we never give them any instructions. We never tell them you have to be good, you better not say anything, or we're going to get you, or anything like that. We just get on the plane. And when we get off, everybody on the plane always comes up to us and talks about all of our children and how wonderful they are.
Yeah.
They're there. They're in the moment. They enjoy the plane. If there's a movie, it doesn't matter if they've seen it 16 times. They watch the movie. They're playing with the stereo stuff. They're listening to stuff. They walk around. I mean, but they're always very peaceful. They're very joyful.
Yeah.
And they meet other people on the plane. And they even calm down other babies around them.
Yeah.
Just like they say about Christ, you know, or Mother Teresa. And that all comes from the kind of relationship that my wife and I have. And
I couldn't agree with you more. I think that most people try and teach their kids what to do, but
they
live a different lifestyle.
Yes,
and kids
right.
don't listen to what you say.
They're
smoking
they do what
cigarettes
you do. And telling their kids, now you shouldn't use drugs.
Where's
the
incongruency
cheating on their income tax
message?
And talking about it. I can't understand why their children lie. They don't get it.
No kidding. Tell me, I know you have a discipline of running, and you were doing that right before this interview.
Yes.
You've been doing it every day for how long?
In October of this year, I will have completed 15 years without missing a day of running a minimum of 8 miles.
That's amazing.
And as a result of doing that and meditating along with it, I haven't had a day of illness in 15 years. I've had a few fevers, I've had a few this and that, a few sniffles, but I haven't had anything, any influenza, any colds, anything that would keep me from running that distance. And I've had some, I'm an athlete, so I've had some bad injuries to my legs and all of that, but I've always been able to run right through them. And instead of it taking weeks and weeks and weeks for these pulls and these injuries to heal, they're usually healed in a day or two. Because I think circulation is not only the key to understanding the universe, it's the key to understanding the universe that you are. You've got to keep yourself circulating all the time. You can't let an old person move into your body.
You know? That's a good point.
Yeah.
I say, behind every old person is a young person saying, what the heck happened?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I remember when I was teaching psychology, I came across a great poster. It was a whole line of babies, a little face, and they were all gurgling and laughing, and just like the ones that you just saw downstairs.
Yes, yes.
And then underneath it were another row of four pictures, was all these old people who were just all sitting there and depressed and looking down and unhappy and with scowls on their face. And the heading said, "What happened?"
Yeah. Let me ask you, what is your major focus of what you're trying to share now? Or let me come back to what I started to ask you earlier. I said, you know, you've gone through a tremendous evolution. Mm. How do you perceive that evolution in your own life over the last 15 years or so?
The evolution is one of, instead of teaching people how to manage their emotions or how to avoid being victimized, I think it's the difference between self-help and self-realization, I guess. Mm-hmm. What I write about is always just a reflection of what I'm going through in my life. My writing is always very personal. The examples come out of my own experience in my own life. And my life has undertaken a dramatic transformation from a person who used to be a human being having a spiritual experience, as I said, to a spiritual being having a human experience.
And I know, profound difference there.
Yes, it is. And I know that who I am is divine. I'm a divine necessity. And each person listening is as well. And I know that there's a grand purpose, a heroic mission that every one of us has on this planet. And I think that my lessons have been much more spiritual, much more peaceful. Consequently, my life has become much more peaceful. And when my life is in harmony and serene, then my writing is that way. I think my writing flows more now. I think my message is that that I know I'm not alone. Hmm. I know that. And I guess if I know I'm not alone and I can go to a higher place within myself, that I believe that anybody can. Yeah. That the same intelligence that flows through you is the same intelligence that flows through me. The only reason that I can't wiggle your finger is because I believe that I'm separate from you.
Yeah.
You know. But it's a oneness that is there. And I've met a beautiful, beautiful man. His name is Deepak Chopra.
Oh, yes. Yeah, we met him recently, and he's invited us to come out and visit
Deepak and I
him.
Have become very, very friendly.
Incredible man.
Yeah, he is. And his, as a matter of fact, my wife just was diagnosed as having a cold nodule on her thyroid and was told that it was 2.5 centimeters and that she would have to have surgery. She went to 3 different endocrinologists, specialists, and each of them said that she would have to have surgery. And that same day I met Deepak, the same day that we thought that my wife might have cancer. They said it could be cancerous and they couldn't take a chance. And that very same day, Deepak and I were doing a program together in Seattle, and we were, along with Louise Hay and Shakti Gawain and Kriyananda, and it was a very, very special day. And Deepak and I, and he came to me, here's this man who's a physician and who grew up studying under Maharishi. I mean, just a brilliant man. And I'm ready to just bow to him. And he's bowing to me, telling me how much he loves me and how much he appreciates my work and all that. And we became like soul brothers. I mean, it was like a man I experienced love for instantaneously. Yeah. And he invited Marcy to come up to his Ayurvedic medicine place up in Lancaster, Massachusetts. And she spent a week up there for the first time in 10 years that she slept alone, that she has been away from the children or away from me. And she went up there alone, and our 16-year-old daughter, we absolutely knew that she could handle this. And she handled 5 children for a week and just became, I mean, an unbelievable mother from sort of a wild kind of teenager who likes to go out and be a teenager, I mean, to a totally, completely responsible person because we believed that she could do it.
Yes.
And my wife went up there for a week and worked with Deepak, and he gave her herbs and oils and
counseling. She cleansed her system.
She came back, and in 1 week's time, Tony, she went back to the 3 endocrinologists, and the cold nodule is gone.
That's fantastic.
It's gone.
That's fantastic.
But she never believed for a second. I mean, it isn't like she said, oh, maybe I have cancer, but. It wasn't like that. She absolutely said, I'm not having surgery. I'm not interested in this. I know that I can do this. I know I can get rid of this. And all I have to do is just get my body balanced. And that's what Ayurveda taught her. Yes. That's what Deepak. So we're doing a program together. East meets West, kind of. Like, and he said to me, he said, it's real interesting. He said, I came to the same conclusions about personal transformation and spirituality and this divineness. He said, I was raised in that tradition and I went through medicine and I'm a scientist. He said, you grew up on the streets of Detroit and you came to the same kind of conclusions. And
truth is truth.
Yeah. And it's like, here we are now talking about various levels of higher consciousness, the different levels that you can reach in your life, and it's been magnificent. It's really been a joy to be associated with them. And that's really the difference between now and then. I mean, you talk about the transformation. The real difference is that I know I'm not alone now, and I know that there's a divineness that's in all of us.
What triggered that knowingness? Because so many people know it intellectually, but they don't embody it emotionally.
I try to think of what it, you know, like what, because we're always looking for things in the physical world that describe, you know, what it is that happened. But there's a word in Zen tradition called satori. We don't have a translation for it in English because we don't do it.
That's a real good point.
Yeah.
We don't have a word. We don't
have
an experience.
That's right. But it's like in Japanese, it's called shibumi. It's effortless perfection or instant awakening. And where you just have this knowing, and it's like I can go back and I could give you right here a whole lot of circumstances that happened in my life when I went to my father's grave, but then it turns out that I had all this hatred towards my father for all these years.
Don't run through the story, because this is an important story.
Maybe
you can share that with us, because I know it was a profound experience in your life.
It truly was.
When was this, first of all?
It was 1974, just before I wrote Erroneous Zones, like months before I wrote Erroneous Zones, like days before I wrote Erroneous Zones.
Had you seen him at any time since he left your family?
Never saw him.
He did.
He left and walked away with on a wife and three boys and never, ever showed up again. Just was gone. Do you want me to tell this
story? Yeah, I think it's very powerful.
It was, I went down to Columbus, Mississippi. I was teaching at St. John's University in Queens. You were 14.
No, that's right.
And it's interesting. I haven't thought of this in quite a while. I had a cousin who was my father's sister's child, whose name was Dorothy Phillips, who I had just met a couple of times. They would never give any information about my father. I was always looking for my father. I spent a lot of time looking for my father.
Why did you want to find him?
I wanted to meet him in a bar. I had a fantasy of just going to a bar and sitting down and saying, "I'm your son. Let me." And this was long before I became well known or anything.
Yes.
This was just, I just wanted to know who this guy was, you know.
Yeah.
When his mother died, I found out his mother died. I went to the funeral, and I was only 13. I was the only one that went, and I went only because I was hoping that he would show up. You know, just so I could meet him, but he didn't come.
Wow.
Anyway, I spent a lot of time looking for him. Then I would always run out of money, or I would run out of desire, or I was just being guided to stay away. Because I know now. See, I can just interject that I know now because I have conversations with my father, and I can see my father in my meditations.
Yeah.
I mean, his soul is there, and in many ways it guides me. I mean, I really think that his life was a lesson for me in how not to do things.
Yeah.
And so I've used it that way, and I see the blessing there. But anyway, 1974 rolls around. I'm 34 years old, and I go down to, I'm invited to go to Columbus, Mississippi to do an investigation of the civil rights legislation that had been just passed in the 60s when Johnson was president, and to see whether some of these colleges in the South were abiding by them. And I was just like a federal consultant, and I would go on campus sort of incognito, and I would sit in classes, and I would write my report, and then I would send it back. And I agreed to do this for a weekend, and Dorothy, meantime, had called and left a message that she said, "Your father is dead." And I didn't know this up until then.
Wow.
Yeah, she said, "Your father is dead. He died in New Orleans," and she gave me the date that he died. And she said, "He's been dead for a while." And it was a shock. I called my mother. I said, "Did you know that?" I asked my mother. None of us knew that. You know, he'd been dead 7 or 8 years. So I got down to Columbus, and I looked on a map, and I was only 200 miles from New Orleans, and I called the infirmary where she gave me the name of the infirmary, and he was an indigent, and they said they found out that he died of cirrhosis of the liver, and he was 49 years old, and they said we don't have any record of where his body as an indigent was just shipped to Biloxi, Mississippi. So I said, "Well, I'm going to Biloxi." I don't know. I mean, I was on a journey then, and this was a spooky time for me. And it gives me that kundalini feeling right now.
I can see it. I can feel it.
Yeah, it's like I get very teary when I think about it. And I went to the rent-a-car place, the National Rent-a-Car, and there was only one rent-a-car place, and this is a dinky little town in Mississippi. Okay, at the Mississippi State College for Women, I think it was, and. I went to the rent-a-car place, and they had one car, and the car was a brand new car. It was a 1974 Dodge Coronet. Okay, it was a blue, and it had no miles on it, 0.009. I said, what? Do they make this car here? How did this car get here? And that car had been shipped in that day, and I was the first person to drive the car. And it was tacked. It was so new that the plastic was on the seats. Right? Oh. And I had to take the plastic off of the covering.
Interesting
on the
metaphor,
seat.
Huh?
Yes. Right. So I got in, and there was no seat belt. There was only one seat belt on the right-hand side. There was no left-hand seat belt. And they didn't even have shoulder belts in those days. So I got out of the car, and I took this, because I've got that sort of determination in me that I'm wearing a seat belt. And I got out of the car, and I took the seat right out of the car and put it on the ground. And there was the other seat belt taped to the floorboard of the car. And it was masking tape was on. It was wrapped in plastic, the buckle, mm-hmm. wrapped in all this plastic. There was a rubber band around it, and then it was taped to the floorboard, obviously to protect it from the cutting the upholstery in transit. And I took all of this stuff off of it and unwrapped it and all that, and inside the buckle there's a card, and it says a business card inside the buckle of this brand new car. This is a true story. And it said Candlelight Inn, Biloxi, Mississippi. So I took the card and I just said, that's interesting. I'm going to Biloxi. It's 200 miles away, 4-hour drive. It was on a Friday afternoon. I put the card in my pocket and I drove to down to Biloxi. And I didn't think much about it. In fact, I picked up a hitchhiker on the way and a kid who was, a migrant fruit picker. And I took him someplace else and I went about an hour out of my way to take him somewhere. And we finally got to Biloxi. I got to Biloxi, and it was about 10 minutes to 5 on Friday afternoon. I think it was the 22nd of August. Reader's Digest did this in a story because they checked out every detail of this, okay? I mean, every detail.
Oh.
And I went to the phone book in the gas station outside of Biloxi. When it said, welcome to Biloxi, I went into the next desk, and I just looked under cemeteries. I was just figured, he's got to be buried in Biloxi. What else would they do with him, you know? And I didn't realize that I was on a real journey at this time. And I called the first cemetery, and it was no answer. And the second one, it was busy. And the third one was a real small listing, like it was an inferior cemetery. Maybe they didn't bury them real deep or something. I don't know. But it was like a real tiny list. So I called it, and it turns out it was just a cemetery plot on the back of another piece of property. And an old man came to the phone. And they kept their records in Coca-Cola can boxes. The Coca-Cola came in. He had to go back. He said, well, we don't have records here exactly. I said, I want to see if a Melvin Lyle Dyer is buried here. And he was gone for what seemed like an eternity, but he came back and he said, yes. He said, he's buried here. And my heart was just beating as fast as you could imagine. I said, well, how do I get there? I'm in Biloxi and I want to come over there. I really feel like I need to. It's my father and I've never met him. And he said, well, I got the death certificate right here. He said, he's buried. He said, your father's buried on the grounds of the Candlelight Inn.
Oh, my God.
And he said, just find that, and it's just inside a ton. And I reached into my pocket. It's a true story.
That's incredible.
And I took the card, and on the back of the card is a map imprinted on how to get to the Candlelight Inn. I mean, it's printed. Like it's got these arrows that go to. And I was only 6 blocks away, and I put it back, and that's when I started getting the BGBBGs, whatever you call them, heebie-jeebies. And I went to the gravesite, and this was in August of 1974, and I stood there. I was 34 years old, and I stood there, and I was sobbing. There was just a little plate on the ground. It said Melvin Lyle Dyer. And I sobbed, and I sobbed, and I cried, and I talked, and I was there for 2.5 hours. It was almost like there was magnets on my feet. I couldn't leave. It was till 7:30. In fact, there was no entrance there. I just had to. There was just a chain across there. He asked me. He said, "When you leave, just put the chain up across, because they didn't want other vandals and that driving through there." And I left there, and what I did in that time, which was so significant for me, and it's why I think of it as an event that was like an unfolding in my life.
Spiritual awakening.
Yeah, it was a spiritual awakening. It was like I forgave my father. That's what I had to do. And I think of forgiveness. I mean, I've studied this now, and I wrote a whole chapter about it, and you'll see it when you believe it. Forgiveness, Mark Twain had a wonderful definition of it. He said, forgiveness is the fragrance that the violet sheds on the heel that has crushed it.
Ooh.
Isn't that beautiful?
Ooh, that is about as beautiful thing I've ever heard. Oh, that's amazing.
And it's like, I think of forgiveness as like a snake bite. You know, it's like you get bit by a snake and you can't unbite yourself. I mean, but nobody ever died from a snake bite. A snake bite doesn't kill you, it's just a bite, you know, and we get bit all the time in all different metaphorical ways. What kills you isn't the bite, it's the venom that circulates after the bite. bite. Yeah. Well, mentally or metaphysically, the venom that circulates in you after the bite, after the things that have been done to you, is the hatred, yeah, and the anger and the unforgiveness. And you think of Christ on a cross, and you think of a soldier, remember, from King, yeah, of Kings. Yes. I'll never forget that image. Yes. And Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. What he's really saying there is, they don't know that they're throwing a spear into themselves when they throw a spear into me, that we're all connected, that we're all one. And until you get rid of that venom, it will destroy you. So whatever it was that I was carrying around towards my father, which was being manifested in all kinds of conscious and unconscious ways in my life, I let it go in that moment. And it was like my father was there with me, Tony. I mean, he was just, and he's with me now. I mean, in fact, I can feel his presence here. Yeah. Now, as we speak, always saying to me, like, where I am, there's no judgment. Yeah. You know, there's no good or bad here. There's no right or wrong in this. There's just like, tell my story if it's going to help somebody to forgive somebody. You know, yeah. And that was my purpose. And every time I do something that is generous and loving and good and helpful to other people, I feel like my father's smiling on me. And once I forgave him, it's funny because in my life at that time, that's when I was getting divorced. I was going through a struggle. That's when I was overweight, like 25 or 30 pounds. I wasn't running. I didn't start running until the year after that. And my writing was really suffering. I was writing professional article stuff just to publish or perish, okay? Yeah. That's where I was. I was trying to get published in different professional magazines and all of that kind of thing. And I'd send stuff in. It was just stuff that, you know, you wouldn't want to read because it was, yeah, just quoting everything else. And it was, you know, the kind of professional, yeah, stuff that, yeah, everybody does. They write to each other. Nobody else reads it. And then when you do write something that appears in Family Circle or Reader's Digest or whatever, or even the National Enquirer,
that's right,
5 million people read it. I mean, give me 5 million neurotic people reading the Enquirer to fix.
That's right.
Rather than a whole bunch of people who are just going to write back in another letter to me only in the form of another article. So I let all of that go.
That's,
and I went back, and Ironia Zones I wrote in 18 days.
In 18 days?
18 days.
Wow.
18 days. There's 22 million of those in print today. You know.
That's amazing. Yeah. Now, it didn't take off right away. You had to take some action.
It didn't take off at all, no. They had one printing, and they expected it to do very little. And
they met their expectations.
Yeah, they were. They told me. They had what they call a list mentality. They said, this is the list. You're on the March list. And it's a clever little title, and it's a nice little book. And if we sell the books that are on our list, they had a first printing of 3,500, then we'll be happy, and you'll make a little money, and we'll make a little, and then we'll move on to the next list in April, and so on. And that was the mentality. And that's a big part of the mentality in publishing,
yeah,
today, as you know. So I just said, well, what will happen if the first printing sells out? Just if. I know it won't. I mean, that's what you're saying. It won't. But just if. His name was Lou. All right?
Right.
And Lou said, Wayne, he said, you're an unknown. He said, it's 3,500 books on hardcover at $7, $6.95. I mean, that was like an outrageous price to put on the book at that time. I said, but just if. And he said, well, if they do, we'll have to put a second printing. I said, okay, fine. And so I became, they wouldn't let me buy them. I tried to buy them. They wouldn't let me. So I became a bookstore. I was in New York at the time, and all you have to do to become a bookstore is just give them a number in Albany, and you're a bookstore. So I became a bookstore by just giving them a tax number. And through that tax number, which I gave them the address of the bookstore that my garage was to become in Long Island, it's true. And I called that day, and I ordered 3,350 copies of your Ironia Zones, and they were shipped to the garage.
So you sold it out.
I sold it, and I went back to Lou 2 days later. I said, Lou, what will happen if we do sell it? He said, Wayne, you've got to stop bothering me. You know, it's like, you're another one of these beginning authors. I said, well, just check. Just check the computer. Just see how it's doing. Because I said, I've been doing a lot of speaking. And I think, and he went to his computer. It's a true story. And I could even tell you his last name, Gullickson. And he went to the computer. He said, oh, my God, this book is doing fantastic. We sold out the whole first printing. So they ordered a second printing, 1,500. They didn't want to take too much of a chance.
Oh, no. Yeah.
I bought all those up, too.
Oh,
I bought the
gosh.
Second printing. And by that time, they didn't have any money for distribution. They didn't have any advertising money. They didn't have any of that. They just,
right.
Because they just didn't do that in those days. So I said, I'm going on the road. And I quit my job as a professor at St. John's. I walked in and I had, you know, I had all these publication credits and I was like a rising star there. And they said, you're insane. You've got guaranteed tenure for the rest of your life. You've
oh,
got a
boy.
Position. Yeah, right. Yeah, you can argue for your misery for the rest of your life, you know. And I resigned. And everybody thought I was nuts except my wife and I. We both knew that this was the right thing. The day I resigned from doing something that I no longer wanted, was totally involved in. I was good at it, but I didn't want to do it. It was like drill. You know, I mean, after you've drilled enough, it's just enough. Drill is drill, okay? But you don't need to keep doing it. I'd learned that in the military. So I drove home on the Long Island Expressway that day, the freest man I'd ever felt. I knew I was about to follow my bliss. I really knew it. And I didn't have any guarantee of any income or anything. The interesting thing about that is that in the following year and a half, I made more money. I was 36 years old now at that time. I made more money without even trying. I never thought for a minute that I would make money because I hadn't made any money on anything I'd written yet. Yeah. I wasn't writing for money. I was writing because writing was just something that I expressed myself. That's just who I am. And I made more money in the next 18 months than I had made in the previous 35 years of my life, like by a factor of 10. And
you were just going out sharing your philosophy with radio stations?
I took the books in a station wagon across the country, and this is the way I did it, if you want to know how I did it. I would arrive in a town like Columbus, Ohio, where they have Good Morning Columbus on the radio, you know, and if you've got a new avocado dip, you're on for an hour, you know what I mean? They're looking for people, okay? Every station's got a talk show. So you just have to find out who they were. And I had a girl back in New York named Donna Gould who was working for the publisher but was willing to work for nothing at night. Just because she loved Erroneous Zones and loved me and loved the whole thing. I mean, she was just involved in the whole process. She really loved it. And so she would call these different stations and all that and book me on Good Morning Columbus and Good Afternoon Columbus and Hello Columbus and Goodbye Columbus and, you know, and all of this kind of thing. And, yeah. And I would have my car full of books. I would arrive in Columbus. I was sleeping in the car. I mean, I did this. I had no money to do this with. Right? And I would sneak showers. I would figure out how to take free showers, you know, in days ends and things, you know.
But you had a committed wife. Yeah. Now, was your wife traveling with you?
Oh, yeah. Sometimes.
Sometimes.
Sometimes. She was also working.
Wow.
And I would go to the bookstores. And first I would call them up, and I'd say, have you got a book called Your Erroneous Zones? And I would do it in like 9 different dialects. And I'd do it in German, and I'd do it in Dutch, and then my wife was with me, she would call, and I'd get these people to call and ask for Erroneous. It's true, this is exactly what we did.
Shameless. I love it. I love it.
But I knew I was going to create the demand. I mean, I didn't think I was doing anything you know, immoral. I was just creating the demand for what it was that I believed in.
Yeah.
And besides, I had 5,000 books I had to get rid of because I had no distribution at all. So
you were what we call committed.
That's right. I was totally involved in the process. And then I would go on the air. Okay.
Yes.
And I would do what we're doing now.
Yeah.
I never tried to sell my books. I never gave the title out. I never said, oh, by the way, my new book is called, and oh, yes, my book is this, and you've seen this on the air. And every time somebody does that, you say, well, they're not involved in it. They're just trying to sell me something, and you move away. I didn't do that. I was just selling myself as a person. I was just talking like we're talking.
Yeah.
And when people talk and are committed and are involved and are authentic and are enthusiastic about what they're saying,
people respond.
People want to know more.
Yeah.
They just want to know more. It's why I let everybody tape all my talks. I never deny anybody to tape my talks to this day.
Yeah.
In fact, I not only allow it, I insist on it. I don't take a cent for it. Anytime I speak, I say, if I'm on purpose rather than an outcome, if I'm on purpose and in the process, then my purpose is to get the message out. That's where I've got to be centrally focused. Not on what's going to come back to me, not on royalties, just on that. So I allow every church, every organization, you can tape me, and you can do anything you want with the tapes. Anything you want. You want to sell them to your customers and all of that, just don't put them into bookstores and make a legal conflict for me with publishers.
Sure.
Yeah, just legal problems.
Sure.
But otherwise, do anything you want with them. Because I figure all that can happen is something good. What can happen if somebody hears an interview of mine, other than they say, gee, I want to hear more of that guy. And off they go to the bookstore, or off they they call for the tapes and all that. Nothing but good can happen.
That's true.
And then you keep circulating and so on. So, I mean, I learned that about 3 years ago when my agent kept saying, you can't tape Wayne Dyer. Now I have a clause in there that says, I insist that you tape me. And do whatever you want with the tapes.
That's true.
So I was, like, on that process. Then I would finish at the interview, and I would go to the same bookstore, and I'd say, by the way, I'm here in Columbus. The Little Professor bookstore, this is one of them I can remember very well. And I said, I just did AM Columbus, and I'm going to do this afternoon's Columbus, and I'm going to do all of this. And the guy said, my God, we've already had 10 phone calls. Well, hell, I knew I'd made them. And I said, well, can I just leave 25 of my books here, and if they don't sell, then you can send them back to me, and here's the address, and right. It won't cost you anything. Just send them back to you. Sure, he said, absolutely. We've already had calls for them. And sure enough, they were getting calls. People yes. were going in there.
Sure.
And that's how I distributed my book. I did that in Columbus. I did that in Baltimore. I did that in Jacksonville. I did it in Tampa. I went to almost every, I shouldn't say every state, but I went to about 75% of the states in the country
wow.
at my own expense, in my own little car, 6 months on the road. And then finally, the book hit the bestseller list. And it was interesting because The Tonight Show was the show that everybody wanted to get on in those days. That's when it was an hour and
yes.
a half. And that story is so phenomenal. I don't know how our time is.
We're fine.
The story of getting on that show, because my Donna was always trying to get me on the show. And she'd call The Tonight Show, she'd call them, and she'd call them, and they'd say, if we hear the name Wayne Dyer one more time, I'm not... Turns out that a friend of mine now, a very good friend named Howard Pappish, was working on the show, and someone had placed a copy of Erroneous Zones in his briefcase, and he was flying back to Los Angeles, and he happened to pick out that book and read it on the plane. Well, he called me, and he asked me if I would be willing to fly out to Los Angeles and do a pre-interview for The Tonight Show. I said, no, I'm busy putting up my screens. I can't do that. What do you mean, can't I come out to Los Angeles? Sure enough, I flew out to Los Angeles, and I went out there. And it's so interesting when you get off of trying to get something
yes.
and just stay on purpose.
Yes.
It's that great quote from Thoreau, if you advance confidently in the direction mm-hmm. of your own dreams, endeavor to live the life which you've imagined, you will meet with a success unexpected in common hours. You want to talk about an unexpected thing. I couldn't get on one national show, Tony. I couldn't get on the Donahue Show. I couldn't get on the Today Show. These are all shows that I've done 100 times since.
Yes.
But I couldn't get on any of them because they said that, you know, who are
trying
you?
To force it.
Yeah, yeah, and I was forcing it. That's right. I was pushing it. But there's another way to reach everybody in the country. And that's to go to everybody in the country. If they won't put you on network television, you can still go out there and do it if you're committed to wanting to do it. So I go out there and I do the pre-interview. And it's the Republican National Convention, 1976, Kansas City. Bob Dole is going to give the keynote address. Now, I had such an angry feeling towards Bob Dole because I got on the show, okay? I got on the show from the result of the pre-interview, and Shecky Green was the host. You know who Shecky Green is?
No.
Great, great comedian in Las Vegas. Super, super guy. One of the nicest guys in the world. And he does 1,000 different dialects. You must get to meet Shecky. He's a great guy. And he was hosting the show. And he asked me if I would, I get on the show. All right? But it's Monday. But the show, for the first time in the history of The Tonight Show, gets preempted because Bob Dole, instead of giving a 45-minute speech, gives a two-hour speech. And it goes over and the show is preempted. So I fly back to Detroit, where I'm back there with my wife. And I find out that the show is preempted. And I'm all excited. I'm telling everybody that in the world that I know that I'm on The Tonight Show that night, and it gets preempted. So, you know, it's like one door closes,
yeah.
another door opens.
Yeah.
Another door opens. It always works this way when you're doing what you're supposed to and getting off. So that was Monday night. Tuesday, Johnny Carson comes in to his meeting with Howard and all of them and says, and they said, we had a guest on last night that was fabulous. He said, the audience just went crazy over him. And Carson said, well, if he was that good, he said, I'd like to have him on before they show that preempted show, which was scheduled for a week from the following Monday. They were going to just set it in there. So I get another call from
Will
you fly back? This time when I fly back, there's a limo, and I got a first-class ticket. And, you know, things have really changed. And I've got my own dressing room. The first time I went in there, it's like, you can dress in the toilet over here. Now I'm in there, and they're pressing my clothes, and they're cutting my hair, which is really like a, you know, not a big job. You know, they charge for a search fee when they do mine. So I go on the show on Wednesday night. This is like two nights later, and I go on with Carson, and Carson says, and we only have maybe 7 or 8 minutes. It was just great. It was super. He was so good to me. And he said to me, you know, this isn't enough time for this. This is really terrific. He said, could you stay over till Friday?
Oh, my gosh.
And do the show again on Friday because, you know, he checked with Freddie DeCorda. And I said, no, screens. I can't do it. I got to get back. So I stayed over till Friday, did the show on Friday. The preempted show showed on Monday. And from not having any national exposure at all across the country, I went from just doing AM Columbus and all these shows all over to getting three network appearances in 5 days.
Wow.
And the book went from, it was on the bestseller list at that time. Before I hit the Carson show for the first time, I got it on the bestseller list by just going across the country as an unknown. I got on The Tonight Show, did it 3 times in 5 days. The Donahue Show started calling us. I did the Donahue Show 3 or 4 times there, and then the Today Show, and it became a, you know, it became like the biggest. Well, yeah. It became the biggest bestseller of the 70s. It was the top selling book for the entire decade, and it was all because I was advancing. I was doing what made sense to me. Yeah. You know, today I don't do that. Today I don't go out and do it that way. I do it another. I trust it'll all work out in another way.
You've built it also, but I think it's really. I really appreciate you sharing the story because a lot of times I think people have interpreted your philosophy to mean just let things happen. And the truth is, you're surrendering, but you're it's faith with work.
As you think, so shall you be.
Right.
Okay, so you act upon what you think about.
Yes.
If you're thinking about what's missing, if you're thinking about the scarcity in your life, if you're thinking about what's wrong, if you're thinking about what you don't have, if that's where your thoughts are and what you're constantly thinking about and processing your world that way, then that will be what you have to act on. You have to act on what's missing. It's just like in a relationship. If you think about what you don't like about somebody in a relationship, then you have to act upon that.
Yes.
Your relationship is really not located in another person. It's located in you, where everything is located, in that invisible part of you. Do you know what everybody said about the reason why Erroneous Zones was so successful?
No.
It was the 70s. It was the me generation. It was the exact right timing. Dyer was lucky. He hit it at the right. You know, they don't know how many. But then I put 45,000 miles on my car one summer.
Yeah.
You know, and that I went out and bought all of those books and all. That. It's like
and took the
successful
risk.
People yeah. are very, very lucky. Just ask any failure. They'll confirm it for you.
This is true. This is true. Yeah. What is the most important? You've shared a couple of lessons, but if you were going to say the most important, say 3 lessons you've got in the last 10 years that you would share with people, what are they?
I know what's at the top, and that is you become what you think about.
Yes.
If you want love in your life, send love out. Have love within you.
Be loving.
Yeah. If it's like I think of the orange, I always give the analogy of if you squeeze an orange, what comes out is what's inside. It doesn't matter who squeezes it or what time of day or what instrument you use or what the circumstances are. You can only get out of an orange what's inside. And if you extend the metaphor to yourself and someone squeezes you, that just puts pressure on you or says something or whatever, behaves in a way towards you that you find objectionable. And out of you comes anger or hatred or tension or stress or bitterness or any of that. It isn't because of who did the squeezing or the circumstance. It has nothing to do with that, as much as we like to convince ourselves of that.
Yes.
It's because that's what's inside. And what's inside is always within our own control. I think the second thing is that Robert Frost said, we all sit around in a ring and suppose, while the secret sits in the center and knows. And what the secret in the center that knows is what it is that constitutes your very life. It's like this room we're in right now is only a room, not because of the walls and the configuration and all the form that's in here. It's because of this here that neither one of us can get a hold of, this silent,
yeah.
empty, invisible space surrounded by form. That's what, like in Zen they say, it's the space between the bars that holds the tiger. And it's the silence between the notes that makes the music. See, music isn't notes, it's silence between notes. You aren't form, that isn't what makes you who you are. What makes you who you are is the invisibleness surrounded by form. That's the secret that sits in the center and knows. Once you know that and make contact with that and realize that that is who you are, that it is out of nothingness, it is out of emptiness, it is out of that silent, empty space that you create every thought, every sound. When you go to make a sound, the sound comes from that nothingness. You know? So nothingness, what we call nothingness, which is everythingness, which is the Tao, you know?
Yes.
And the Tao that can be described is not the Tao, you can't describe it, it just is, it's in every one of us. Once you know that and go there and consult that, then you can not only affect your own physical life, but you can truly affect the physical life outside of you. Deepak Chopra and I were having lunch up in Seattle this day, and we talked about doing this new program. We talked about there are 4 ways to, we were just playing, toying. We said there are 4 ways to get strawberry ice cream. So let's think of the 4 ways to get strawberry ice cream. You know, and he talks in this very wonderful Indian accent.
Yes.
You know, Indian accent in yes. India. You know, yes. I talk with a funny Detroit accent. Right? You know, and there's a lot more people in India than there are here. So we're talking about what are the 4 ways to get strawberry ice cream? And I said, well, if I want strawberry ice cream, I just have to have a thought. And the thought is, I want some strawberry ice cream. Now I'll just go get it. Okay,
yes.
So I go off to Haagen-Dazs or I go off to the grocery store and I get, so that's like a thought and then you act on the thought. Now there's a second way to get strawberry ice cream, and that is to have a thought and then to send one of your kids to get strawberry ice cream. It's called slavery, okay? It's like, I want some strawberry ice cream, go get it for me. So you have a thought, and then somebody else goes and gets it for you. That's the second way to get strawberry ice cream. A little higher level consciousness. You don't have to work so hard. It's got somebody else doing it for you. There's a third way to get strawberry ice cream. And the third way to get strawberry ice cream was what Deepak offered. He said, you just think, I'd like to have some strawberry ice cream. And then someone walks by and says, excuse me, is this your strawberry ice cream? And you say, wow, yeah. I was just thinking of that. And now everybody listening has had that experience.
Absolutely.
Where you just think of, you know, you think of your sister and you haven't seen her in 7 years, and all of a sudden she's calling you or whatever. And it's like you have affected. You don't think you have. You just think that's some hunt, that's some coincidence. But we know that there's no chaos, that there's order in chaos at the subatomic level. We know that. So it's like you think of something and then it just appears for you. And people say, well, if there's three ways, what could be the fourth? And we've seen this. Well, let's see. I'd like to have some strawberry ice cream. And you manifest it.
Yes.
You just manifest it.
Yes.
Or as Christ said, even the least among you can do all that I have done and even greater things. I mean, the gift of fish and loaves, the gift of feeding others, the gift of... And what do you do when you go to sleep and when you're in pure thought? But everything you need for your dream, you manifest. So you need a Lamborghini? You need someone to chase you with a knife? You need a father that's going to abuse you? You need whatever characters you need for your dream, you create it. Now when you wake from your dream, you don't look back at your dream and say, where's my Lamborghini? Because listen, folks, everybody knows it's neurotic to be attached to an illusion.
Yes. Oh, that's beautiful.
I mean, why would anybody be? So all you have to do to learn not to be attached to this illusion is to die while you're alive. You know, that's what the Sufis say. When you die while you're alive, you look back on your life and you realize that you can't own anything. You can't have any of it. Yeah. So what you do is you detach yourself from it. And the more you detach yourself from it, the more you get. And that's the great lesson.
Who is Wayne Dyer? I know he's a spiritual being, but what are your metaphors for yourself? Who are you besides that metaphor? That metaphor is so all-inclusive.
Yeah. My metaphor is that I am not in the world. The world is in me. I really feel that in every cell of my being, the universe exists. It's like I'm like a pharmacy. I mean, I can create. What do I need for to heal this body? For example, if healing is what I'm talking about, who Wayne Dyer is this ability to, if I need Valium, to create it. Sure. Deepak tells me the story of when he went to London. And there was a guy next to him drinking, he had 8 drinks before they had gotten halfway there. And finally he said to him, he said, you're my buddy. He said, I'm going to buy you a drink. And Deepak said to him, I'm making my own. And it's like,
that's
knowing
great.
That, like,
yes.
I mean, I know that who I am is those birds you hear out here right now. I mean, when I see them flying, I soar with them. That's who I am. I am all of it. I mean, I'm not separate. I'm not even separate from you. Like I said before, it's like I can wiggle this finger because I believe that there's a connection between some kind of a thought which is invisible and the wiggling of this finger. But I can't see that connection. I can't get a hold of that. And if I believe in the oneness of it all, that means that if you can wiggle your finger, that same oneness is there. Yeah. I've got to detach myself from my separateness and believe that I can't be you. I am it all. I am the sun that comes up in the morning. I am the birds that fly. I am the flower. I am that invisible force that is in every living thing that allows it to be. That's who I am.
How do you help somebody who sees themselves as separate not only from life but every sense of life? How do you help somebody like that to bridge the gap to where they remember who they really are?
The only way you can do it, I think, and I've been at this business a long time of trying to help people and writing books about it. A lot of books I wrote long before Erroneous Zones that were about counseling and was a therapist for years. I think that the notion of that when the student is ready, the teacher will appear.
Yeah.
So it's like all I can do is help people to get ready. That's all I can do. Yeah. And see, I mean, I picked up the Bhagavad Gita 3 years ago. Okay, now I've had the Bhagavad Gita in my library since I was in college, but I've never read it. And I've seen it on, I've seen it 100 times.
Sure.
So finally, one day, I'm here and I pick up the Bhagavad Gita, and I read it, and I say to myself, it's about time they wrote something like this. This is really terrific. Okay. Then I see that it's about 2,500 years old, or 6,000 years old, or whatever it is. All right. But it's been there all along.
Yeah.
But I wasn't ready. But when I'm ready, it's like it soars into my life, and I go to the mailbox, and what I need is ready. And it's like we were talking about earlier, when I need to give a speech and I need to recite a poem, or even with prosperity, if I'm feeling like I need to have more money or to more my investments to be, but it's like it all gets, the right person shows up and the right thing, it all gets handled.
Yeah.
It's like trusting your intuition and knowing that everybody has it. So all you can do is help people to get convinced that they have this power within them, that it isn't something I have and you don't. It's something that you have but you haven't used yet.
Yeah.
And the fact that you haven't used it yet is no reason to judge yourself badly or even to be mad at yourself. You ought to be saying, I haven't been ready. You know, now I am. And as soon as you acknowledge that you're ready, when the student is ready, then you'll find your teachers appearing. And your teacher might be like my little kids who walked into your room.
Yes.
Or when John asked me, he said, will you do this interview? My first inclination was no. I am here doing something else. I'm here with my family and all of that. And then I got this, I meditated on it, and I got this really nice letter. And it was like, and I thought, I've got to talk to Tony. I've been wanting to talk to Tony.
Yeah.
And Tony's got something to learn from me, and I've got something to learn from Tony. So the opportunity is here, and we've like missed each other on a lot of occasions.
Yes.
I mean, we've been with each other, but we've also missed, we've been on the same programs in the same cities where you spoke in the morning and I spoke in the evening, and you've been gone and I've been gone.
Yeah.
And we've been sort of like being thrown at each other, but just sort of missing.
Yeah.
And I said, we've both got something to learn from each other, so let's do that. I've heard some things about you from other people that I didn't like. You've probably heard some things about me that you, I said, the way that you get it all in harmony is that you don't ignore it. You don't, you go with each other. So you walk into my house and my children are in love with you in a second. You emit a beautiful kind of spirituality. I see that. Whatever you are going through in your life I know there are struggles with your fame. I mean, you've come very young, very fast, very powerful, and I've got a enormous organization about you, and I wanted to say to you, I don't want you to get swallowed up by it. You know, I want the essential beauty that is within you to flower, and to sometimes you have to say. I said that's one of the things you got to say is no, and I like to say it, but I'm not as good at it. But I'm a lot better at it than I used to be. So it's like what I'm saying is there's a mutual thing here. There's like
I appreciate the gift by the way, very much.
Yeah, and likewise, I appreciate the gift of being with you. And so I just let go of all of the other stuff. I said, this is a wonderful opportunity. Let's do it.
Yeah.
And you know what that came from? That came from nothingness. That didn't come from anybody telling me how to do it or what I should do. That came from a
trust.
Came from my own intuition. Yeah, trust, surrender.
Yeah.
But my intuition said, see, I told my wife when I got that, I said, I'm not doing any interviews. I said, I'm not doing this. You know, and she said, you keep saying that. Methinks you protested too much. I said, but I'm not doing any interviews. You know, and then she said, read the letter. And I read the letter, and I said, she said, what does your intuition say? What is God telling you? You
know,
is God telling you? You know, how may I serve? That's my mantra. How may I serve? How may I serve? How may I serve? Always ask that. Not what's in it for me, but how may I serve? And as I kept saying that, I said, my intuition says, do it. She said, call him and do it.
Wow.
And that,
I have another thanks to make when I go downstairs.
Yeah. But we do that with each other all the time.
That's
it's
neat.
Like that, and that it's like trusting that intuition. You know.
Yeah.
It's a very, very powerful thing. And it's like it never, ever guides you wrong. The only time I've, in all my investments that I've made since, and I have a whole financial philosophy of giving a certain percentage of it away unconditionally, and also paying yourself first. You know, it's like reinvesting what you make back in yourself and in your family and all that. And the only time I've ever taken a loss financially in any of my investments was when I ignored my intuition once. And I invested in something that was not conducive to the environment. All right? I don't even want to say what it was because it's neither my purpose to plug nor to blame anything else. But my intuition said, no, Wayne, this isn't, they're doing something that is in conflicts with what you believe.
Right.
But the yields were high.
Yeah.
And they were guaranteed. And it was like, and I put $155,000 into this thing, and they went bankrupt, and I lost that $155,000, but I gained so much.
I was going to say, because you never forget those lessons.
Yeah, it was such a great lesson, and since then, I've only, every time I invest anything, I always ask, where's this money going? What's it going to be doing? And then it just comes back to me like tenfold. So it's all been made up in many, many ways. So it's like I ignored my intuition once, and I paid a price, but I learned it was a great lesson. It was a terrific lesson.
What's the purpose of life?
Purpose of life is real simple for me. It's Joel Goldsmith has a wonderful book called Parentheses in Eternity. And you are a parenthesis. He says your life is a parenthesis in eternity. It opens at your conception. It closes at your death. But eternity surrounds it. So that there was an instant before you came into form, if you believe in eternity, in which you went from formless to form. The question to ask is not how did I do it? Did I sign up for it? Did God do it? Is it a Big Bang Theory, which is an interesting metaphor?
It's true, isn't it?
or whatever. It's like, don't ask that question, because that's just trying to analyze, that is to break apart, something that is not breakable, the Tao. It's trying to understand the Tao. So to ask the question, why? Why would you go from formless to form? The answer to that is so simple for me. It's like I used to wonder about that all the time, and now it's like so simple. You can't get anything while you're here in this parenthesis. You can't have a thing. You think you can own it, you don't get any of it. It's the jewelry that adorns you adorns another in another instant. The house that you own, the cars, all of that kind of stuff. That's just all like a little loan and a little lease, and then it's gone. And if you get attached to it anyway, it'll destroy you. So yeah. You can't have anything. Yeah. So if you can't have anything, if you can't get anything while you're here, then purpose must have something to do with giving rather than getting. And to me, the purpose of life is to give. The purpose of life is to enrich the lives of others in some way. Yes. The measure of your life will not be in the duration of your life. It will be measured in the donations of your life. Okay, what you are able to give of yourself. Because you can't get anything. The only thing you can do with your life is give it away.
Yeah.
You can just give it away. Every day, your form deteriorates a little more. It's heading towards the closing of parentheses. And once you know that, then you know that you can't have anything. You can't stop that. Nobody can stop that. So all you can do is just keep giving your... And the more you give away, the more that comes back. What goes around comes around is not just a funny little song title. Yeah. It is a powerful, powerful message.
And understanding it basically shifts the quality of life.
Well, sure, Tony. It's like getting your life on purpose. Yeah. If your purpose of life is to give, then get your life on purpose and get everything that you do on purpose. If you're driving a cab, don't be thinking about how much of a fare you're going to get. Yeah. Think about how can I serve this person and let the fare take care of itself. Yeah. If you're a salesperson and you're thinking about my quotas and what I'm going to get, you're not on purpose. If you're thinking about the quotas of the person you're serving, that person is going to send you 21 names tomorrow of people that they want you to serve as well. Yeah. It's like the more you give in anything that you do, if you're a dentist, don't think about how much money you can make. Think about making this person's tooth and his mouth as healthy as it can be. Yeah. The universe will take care of the rest. Purpose means giving, not getting. And once you get that, and it's like that's how you have to orient your whole business. That's how I've oriented my entire business of... my books. Do you know that everybody who writes me a letter gets a book?
It's fantastic.
No charge whatsoever, no expectations, no nothing. And anybody who writes me and says this tape didn't work, they get a free set. You know, it doesn't make any difference. I don't want to hear about it. Somebody wrote me a letter from Seattle, and they came all the way over to hear me at that program that I was on that I'd mentioned. I was the keynote speaker. I was the last speaker. And they had to go back because their father was sick, and they spent $100, and they couldn't, and they were very upset. I sent her the $100 and the set of the tapes of the whole day. Yeah. It's like, that's what I believe in doing. Except when people tell me I have to do it.
I was going to say, I think there's one organizing principle for you, and that's freedom.
That's right. It's because a gift is not a gift when it's somebody telling you what to do. Then it's a debt.
Or
it's
when
a
they
debt.
Expect it.
That's a debt.
Yeah.
And I don't want any debts.
We live by the same philosophy there. I would agree with you.
So if you demand from me that I give you something or tell me that I have to give it to you, you're not giving me an opportunity to give. You're just giving me a debt. And I've got enough of those.
Yeah. This is wonderful.
It's been great. It's been a great interview. Yeah,
really,
it's been nice. And it's like, it gives us a connection, you know.
Yeah. What makes Wayne Dyer laugh? I'd be curious, because I know you're easy to smile and laugh, but what gives you the most tickle, the most joy in your life?
I think myself. I think I make myself laugh, and I laugh at myself. I really
see... What a great skill.
Yeah, I really see the folly of it all. I mean, if you ever listen to me speak in public... most of my laughs are just like poking fun at myself.
Yeah.
I poke fun at not having any hair. I've been using that for a year. You know, I just told you this is not really a bald head. It's a solar panel for a sex machine, you know. And those kinds of
That's great.
And also my children really make me laugh. My baby especially. I mean, when they're babies especially, yeah. Because babies are, I mean, under, say, two, you know, they make me laugh. My little boy, I only have one little boy and six daughters, and that little guy, just, you know, last night, I mean, at 11 o'clock at night, we were both laughing so hard in the bed in my little studio. That's where we go down and sleep at night. And just telling stories. I ask him, he always says, tell me a scary story. I said, well, you tell me one. And he just made up the funniest, craziest kinds of things. Children make me laugh. Animals make me laugh. But I really laugh at the folly of it all. Yeah. I mean, so many people think that we come into this world and we have just this short time and then it's over, and there's no joy, there's no laughter in that. To me, I mean, I'm laughing at the. Someone once said that he said, I don't try to make my audience laugh. He said, I try to make God laugh.
Whoa, that's great.
And I really like that. It's
that's
like,
nice.
Yeah,
it's, I think he's laughing all the time.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there's a wonderful story that Yogananda tells of a black man in the South back in the 40s and 50s, when it was really, really terrible down there. And he worked in a white church, an all-white Baptist church, where they wouldn't allow, but he was the janitor, and they wouldn't allow any black people to come in and worship. And over he would ask the minister, couldn't I just come in and worship with you on Sunday? That's all I really want to do. And the minister said to him over and over again, I can't let you do that. I would lose my job. I would like to, but I can't. So finally he went and got into deep prayer. And in his deep prayer, he asked Jesus, you know, why Christ? Why can't I just pray with those same people where I work every Sunday? And Jesus responded to him, I've been trying to get into that church for 20 years and they won't even let me in. and it's like, it's a metaphor. Like,
that's wonderful.
They think that they're praying to me, but I can't even get in. So it's,
Or
Churchill had one of the great lines of all time. We'll talk about humor and great
yes.
people. He was a man that I really admired. I remember the day he died. I was teaching at a school in Detroit, at Pershing High School in the inner city. And, Churchill was in the hospital, and he was prime minister in 1945, and just after the war was over, and he was having such a struggle with Parliament and all that, and he had to go into the hospital for surgery, and a nurse came in, and she had to give him a bedpan because he couldn't get out of bed, and she was carrying out his bedpan. And he started laughing uproariously. And she said, what in the world are you laughing about? And he said, I was just thinking that that's the first movement of mine that's been carried out since I've been prime minister. And like all of the great ones have that kind of a sense of humor.
That's
that makes
right.
me laugh.
In those moments.
Yeah, that makes me laugh.
How do you want to be remembered?
I don't care if I am.
Yeah, I had a feeling that would be your
yeah,
response.
I've thought about that, and I just...
Do you want to be remembered by your children?
Doesn't matter. Hmm. Yeah, I just want to be with them while I'm here and love them and be as loving as I can. And then whatever they do with it will be what they do with it. Whatever... See, I always tell my children that that your reputation is not in your hands. Like,
yeah.
you and I both have a very public reputation,
yeah.
right? But I've heard some... wonderful things about you, and I've heard some really scabby things about you, and vice versa. Right? But it's not your reputation is located in all the other people. If you give a talk to 2,000 people, you got 2,000 reputations.
That's true.
And you have no control over it whatsoever.
Yeah.
You go to school. I tell my children, you go to school, and there's 30 kids in your class, and you got 30 reputations every day.
Yeah.
You have the only thing you have control over is your character,
yeah.
and that is yours. So it's like when you do go out into the world, don't be concerned about how you'll be remembered, because that's just going to be, if there's 10 million people exposed to you, there's going to be 10 million remembrances.
That's true.
Just be concerned about your character. And that's what I try to do. I try to walk the talk.
It's clear you do. And
yeah.
I think your greatest gift is that you are a character.
Yeah, that's true. I am. Yeah.
I appreciate this time with you very, very much.
Thank you. God bless you.
God
I appreciate
bless
it.
You.
Yeah.